You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Lori Kalkovin, who is an author of children's books. Lori Kalkovin has always been fascinated by history, and especially by the ordinary people who get caught up in extraordinary moments in history. She likes the small moments and bizarre facts that mostly get left out by the serious history books, like whether or not a broken egg kept the American Revolution on track, and how putting your hands in your pockets and jingling change could lead to an arrest in Nazi-occupied France. While she was researching her biography of George Washington, she started wondering about life during the Siege of Boston, and soon a character named Daniel was whispering in her ear, telling her about his secret work for General George Washington, and she wrote the novel Daniel at the Siege of Boston, 1776. A biography of Harriet Tubman led to a second novel in her Boys of Wartime series, Will at the Battle of Gettysburg, 1863. Her third historical novel, Michael at the Invasion of France, 1943, rounds out the series, and that's the book that I spoke to Lori about when I interviewed her a couple weeks ago. My first question for Lori was just to ask if she could talk a little bit about how she came to be a writer.
I always wanted to be a writer, and I went to college for journalism, but I really wanted to work in book publishing. Mm-hmm. And so when I got out of college, I came to New York City to work in publishing, and I got a job at Book of the Month Club. And I spent 20 years working in publishing. And like many people working in publishing, I had always planned to write one day, mm-hmm. you know, either later or when I retired, or I was always going to write one day. And when 40 was looming, I decided that if I didn't start writing, it was never going to happen, that I had to make it happen. I was never going to find the time. I was never going to find the perfect idea. I just had to make it happen. So I started getting up early in the morning and writing for 30 or 45 minutes before I went to work. And it surprised me. It took me a while to find my voice. But in that daily writing, what happened was I discovered that my heart and my voice really were in children's publishing. And I didn't work in children's publishing at the time. I worked on adult books. And so I started writing a children's novel, and I gradually changed my career. I started a new book club for Book of the Month Club for teenagers and eventually went to work for the Scholastic Book Club. So I spent 3 or 4 years working in children's publishing while I was writing and trying to sell my first novel and all of those things. And I have to tell you that the children's writing world is a really wonderful one. It's a really supportive community. It's a lot less competitive than the adult writing world, and I mean, writers are less competitive with each other. Mm-hmm. Still mm-hmm. have to get a book published, and it's just been a really lovely experience. And I don't think I'd ever want to go back and write for adults now. I just really love writing for children, and how excited they are when they read a book and meet an author and all of those things. And I experienced books very intensely as a child. I was a huge reader, and I think that's why I'm writing for children. And also, I think there's probably a 10-year-old, you know, my emotional age might still be 10 or something.
So how many books have you written?
I've written a lot. I've written almost 50.
Oh, wow.
And about 3 or 4 years after I started writing, I had an opportunity to do some freelance writing, and I decided to leave my job and become a full-time writer. So a lot of the books I've written don't have my name on them. I've written a lot of media tie-in novels that are attached to children's television shows or movies. I've done some ghostwriting, and I've written a lot of nonfiction for the Scholastic Book Clubs, you know, titles that are, you know, have never been available in the store. They're only sold through the book club. So I've written a lot of titles that no one has ever heard of or that my name is not on.
Okay.
But my first original novel was called Daniel at the Siege of Boston, and that was the first book in my Boards of Wartime series.
Okay, so this is specifically your series. I was going to ask you that, too. There won't be other authors adding to this series.
No, it is my series.
Okay. Now, I'm just curious, when you ghostwrite or when you work on a project where your name does not appear, is it a contractual obligation that you not identify yourself as the author of that book?
That's interesting. Only in one case is it a contractual obligation that I don't identify myself. But so in general, if my name is not on a book, if I am a ghostwriter, I don't talk about it publicly. It is something I have on my resume, but I don't talk about it out in the world.
Okay, interesting.
I don't identify the books.
So it's sort of it varies from contract to contract, and there's a general ethics around it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the latest Boys of Wartime book, Michael at the Invasion of France, 1943. What inspired you specifically to write Michael's story?
Well, I knew that I wanted to write a World War II story next, and I did what I always do when I begin a historical novel. I began reading very broadly about World War II, and I settled onto World War II France, mostly because I've been to France a few times and, you know, took college France, and I was always very interested in the French resistance in World War II.
Right.
And as I was doing a lot of reading, I stumbled across this line of almost like the underground railroads that helped British and American pilots who had been shot down or crashed make their way across France and into Spain so that they could rejoin the war effort. And it was something I hadn't known about before, but I immediately became fascinated by it. And I did more and more reading, both from the resistance side, the people who took care of the pilots and the airmen, and also quite a few of the airmen have written memoirs.
Okay.
So I was able to get a lot of firsthand accounts of what their experiences were like. So I felt like I was able to make a story come to life.
Now, I'm curious if you were able to talk to any adults who did some of this work when they were children, or are they at this point, is that too late? I mean, I'm trying to think how old these children would be. Well, no, they would probably be in their 80s and 90s now, right?
Right. You know, I did not, mostly because I didn't have an opportunity to go to France while I was doing my research. So while I read some firsthand accounts, I wasn't able to talk to any people who had been children and did the kind of work Michael does while I was researching the novel.
So maybe we should talk in more detail about what he does do. He helps the resistance effort by doing small tasks at first, and then eventually he gets a lot more responsibility. Do you want to just say a couple things about that?
Sure. When Michael begins, early on in the novel, he overhears General de Gaulle's speech on the BBC asking the French people to keep the flame of resistance alive. And he and his friend form a resistors club, and they start doing little things like tearing down German posters, scrawling V for victory on walls and on German posters. And they, in one episode, one incident, they go to a movie theater, and they filled their pockets with inspiring messages. And halfway through the film, they stand up and start shouting, Vive la France and Long live General de Gaulle, and they throw all of their messages around in the movie theater and then dash out before... before they can be snatched by a German. And he's doing things like that, things that are almost, he sees as fun. And during the roundup of the Jews, the famous roundup of the Jews in, excuse me, I'm looking up the date, about halfway through the occupation, Michael and his friend help a Jewish girl and boy who live in their building. And in taking that girl to the train station and in watching his friend, Michael realizes that his friend has become much more involved in the resistance, in the real resistance, not their little club. And he asks to get involved. And he begins by doing little tasks for the resistance. And eventually, because Michael is half American and speaks English, eventually he's called on to interact with some of the American and English pilots who are being moved out of France. And it's only then that he discovers what he's been doing.
Right.
And he begins, meeting these airmen at one train station and escorting them to another and things like that until, of course, the Gestapo crashes the network. And then Michael himself has to go on the run.
Right. One aspect of writing that I'm always very impressed by when someone does it well, and I thought you did it very well, is the task of summarizing a large chunk of history. In this case, you did it in the prologue to sort of introduce readers, young readers, I'm assuming mostly these are young readers, yes, to the history that leads up to the time that Michael was living in France and doing this work. Can you just talk a little bit about trying to summarize a large chunk of history that way?
Well, it was really difficult, but I knew that most of my readers would come to this with almost no history, no knowledge about World War II, except, you know, maybe the barest bones they had learned in school. My readers are mostly 8 to 12, and they don't get a lot of World War II history in their curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I had to bring it up to speed. I had to bring them up to speed pretty quickly, and of course they don't have a lot of patience for boring stuff, so I had to get to the exciting stuff really fast, too. So, I can't exactly tell you how I did that. I started out with probably a 10-page prologue, and I just kept cutting it and cutting it and cutting it until I felt I got in all of the information I needed and yet was short enough that kids might actually read it before they started reading the story.
Now, when you worked in publishing, were you an editor? I mean, I'm just wondering if that's how you were able to approach this.
I did work in editorial in book clubs, but it's different than being an editor in a publishing house because I didn't actually edit books. What I did was select them. We bought books from other publishers and offered them within our book clubs.
Okay.
So I didn't actually do actual editing, but I certainly for most of my career read a book a day for 20 years. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
That helped.
So maybe this is a very specific question, but it occurred to me while I was reading your book that your young adult readers, and 8 to 12 is maybe even younger than I was imagining, so maybe they have no context in which to digest this. But I'm just wondering if your readers find it surprising that Pétain's government collaborated with Hitler. I always just have been fascinated by that time in history.
Yeah, they are. And, it's funny when I talk to kids in schools and classrooms, they always ask why. And I really can't answer that. I think that there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe at the time, and there were some people who admired the Nazis and the Nazi Party before the invasion. And that's certainly part of the reason why, and part of it was just self-preservation. And I think we also have to remember that there were more than a million POWs, French POWs, in Germany during the entire occupation. Mm. They were arrested when Germany overran the country, and they were really held in Germany for most of the war. And it was a way of keeping the French people in line.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big part of the reason. But, there was also pervasive anti-Semitism all over Europe, and France was certainly not excluded from that. So that was part of it as well.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned speaking to your readers when you go into, I take it, do you go into schools to do readings, or how do you meet most of them?
Well, I go to a lot of children's book festivals, and there are quite a few here in the New York City area,
okay,
including one in Hudson, New York in May. But I also sometimes get invited to schools to do what we all call, children's writers all call author visits or school visits. And usually what that means is talking to groups of students throughout the day in three or four presentations about books and writing in general and things like that. It's a really exciting way to meet readers. And I don't remember ever having an author come to my school when I was a kid, but I would have gone crazy for that. So it's nice to be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about writing suspense. This book has some pretty intense moments of suspense, just given the subject matter. And I noticed three different ones. I'm sure there's more examples throughout the book, but there were three in particular that I wanted to talk about. One is early on in Michael's narrative, he mentions his secret activities, but he doesn't tell the reader what those are. He just mentions it in a nonspecific way, that his mother is vaguely aware that he has secret activities. And so that kind of builds suspense. Another moment that I wanted to mention was that at the end of one chapter, there's a moment where a German voice is screaming, open up, and banging on Michael's family's door. And then you ended the chapter, and then the next chapter begins pretty much with that exact same line. I think maybe you changed a few words, but it picked up right where it left off, but there's this little chapter break in between that makes us turn that page and want to know, you know, what's going to happen. And then later in the book, and I think throughout the book in a few places, you had sort of cliffhanging moments at the end of chapters. And again, they don't leave us hanging for too long, but they sort of make us want to read on. So anyway, these were all very good moments of suspense for me as a reader of this book. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about writing suspense.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have to say that I'm not sure that I think it through that carefully and able to be that articulate about it. But, I do like to end chapters on cliffhangers because I want people to keep turning the pages, and those are my favorite kinds of books when I was a kid and still, where you just don't want to put it down. And right. So I search for those moments as a way to end chapters. And also, they often do seem to be a good cutoff, because often those cliffhanger moments, you enter into a next scene, you enter into the next scene right mm-hmm. afterward. And so they actually seem to be almost natural cutoff points in writing a scene. And for 8 to 12-year-olds, certainly you don't want your chapters to be too long, but, readers like to have a break at the end of a section. So even if they're going to keep reading, it's nice to have that break at the end of a chapter. So I do try very hard to keep my chapters short and to end on a note that readers want to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, Lori, I'm wondering if maybe this would be a good time for you to read a couple pages from Michael at the Invasion of France, 1943, and then we can talk some more about it.
Sure. I'm going to read a section from Chapter 10, and Michael has gotten involved in what he thinks of as the real resistance, the grown-up resistance. And he's begun going on errands with his friend Jacques. He's begun delivering secret documents and dropping them off with people in cafes. And how he knows the right person is that if it's a man, his beret will be at his feet. And Michael will stop and say, you dropped your hat, monsieur. And when he hands him the hat, we'll hand him an envelope. And he's done that a few times now. And he's actually starting to get bored. He's beginning to think that his resistance games, shouting in movie theaters and tearing down posters, was more exciting. So he's just begun to run the errand himself, and I'll begin to read at that section. After that, I ran the errand myself. No one ever told me what was in the envelopes, but once or twice a week, Jacques would whisper to me that the Bluebird expected a visit. The person in that cafe never said more than thank you. Everything went smoothly, and I even grew a little bored with my assignment. My childish version of resistance work was a lot more fun than this new job. Then one day in November, there was a strange man at the table. No one told me to expect a new contact, but the man's beret sat at his feet, as it should. Still, something wasn't right. He made idle chit-chat with the man at the next table instead of reading like the others had done. I rode past him and made a loop around the block. This time I stopped at the corner and studied this new person. I watched him call out to a pretty girl who walked by. His French was perfect. He didn't sound German. Suddenly I realized why I was troubled. The man was too loud and too well fed. Only the Germans had enough to eat, and a good résistant would never draw attention to himself in public. Even I knew that. The man chuckled at the way the girl ignored him and then sat back with a sigh. He took out a package of cigarettes. I froze. The package was a German brand. I felt as if I was being lit on fire when he brought a match to the tip of his cigarette and drew the smoke into his lungs. The man was a Nazi or one of their collaborators, and whatever I carried in my envelope was definitely forbidden. His eyes swept the street and came to rest on my bicycle and me. He smiled. Are you looking for me? A résistant would never ask such a question in a public place for others to hear. He tapped his foot next to his beret, trying to draw my attention to it. I didn't want to look, but my eyes darted to his feet of their own accord. I could feel my face turning red, giving me away. No, no, monsieur, I stammered. I'm looking for my mother. She must have already gone home. I'll go there now. His face hardened, and he eyed me suspiciously. I pretended not to notice. I wheeled my bike around and got ready to cross the busy Champs-Élysées. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw him get to his feet. Wait, he yelled. Wait. I pretended not to hear him. I looked for a break in traffic. Stop that boy, the man yelled in his perfect French. Then he switched to German. The only word I understood was halt. I heard footsteps behind me and a loud whistle. A black Mercedes roared to life. The Gestapo was after me.
Thank you very much. That is a great section where he starts to realize that he's getting in a little deeper than he realized. It's not so boring after all.
Right.
Yeah, that seems like a moment when that seems like a really important transitional moment in Michael's growth as a character and as a boy.
Yes.
Another moment that I thought was important for his growth in those same two ways was there comes a time where he begins to lie in order to protect his family and friends. And as I was reading about that, I mean, he's lying both to people he doesn't know and sometimes occasionally to people he knows and likes, but he understands that the larger importance of protecting people close to him is more important than whatever deference he might have to adults, which I think is really hard for kids to do. So I was thinking that was a really good moment for the reader to understand that he's growing up. Did you think about that as you were writing that?
I'm not sure that I thought about it that carefully, but I knew that he would want to protect his mother from whatever activities he was doing. And a lot of children who got involved in the resistance, actually their parents didn't know. Sometimes it was a whole family effort, and sometimes the parents didn't know what the children were up to. And so I knew that he would lie to his mother in an attempt to keep her safe. But he also at the same time wanted to keep his activities going.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to be forbidden from doing that. And so that certainly was part of it. And then, of course, he does eventually have to get his mother involved because he has no other choice.
Right.
But I think his initial lies were, again, to keep his family safe and to keep his activities a secret. So I'm not sure that – I don't think he ever saw that as a choice he had.
Right.
So okay. It wasn't something that he you know – normally when I think kids lie, they have to think about it quite carefully, you know, about the moral ramifications if they've been raised well. So certainly lies of this magnitude, but because of the dire situation, Michael doesn't have that. Doesn't have the bomb.
Now, I was interested in your research. I kept expecting that as an American by birth, his mother would be an early target for the Nazis in their sweeps of neighborhoods and things. Did that not start happening until the Americans and Germans declared war on each other?
The Americans were not bothered until after America had entered the war. And actually, the Germans had so much on their hands in France by then that even some Americans went quite a while before being questioned and followed by the Germans. And many Americans were allowed to live in France as they always had. You know, they had to sign in at the, you know, local police station every week or things like that. But many Americans simply continued to live their lives.
I found that really interesting. I never knew that they weren't. Go ahead.
Yeah, but by the time the United States entered the war, the Germans really had their hands full.
Yeah.
They were occupying so many countries and they had so many resistance units in addition to armies on their heels that the idea of an American, especially an American woman, a mother in France, was not something that they would have devoted a lot of attention to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A major theme, I would say, of this book, although it's not on every single page, but it's very important, is the theme of trying to impress others, or in Michael's case, make someone else proud, mm-hmm. as opposed to acting in a way that makes ourselves feel like we've done the right thing, or proud, or feel like we're living our lives in the way that we want to. And I think that's a wonderful message to get across to young readers, because everybody, when they're, you know, 8, 10, 12 years old, is always trying to impress somebody else. Did that happen organically when you were writing the book, that this came to you as an idea for what's motivating him? Or did you know that when you started the book, that would be part of the story?
I learned that very quickly when I started exploring the character. I tend to do a lot of free writing around my characters before I actually start writing the book. And it seemed like every time I did a character meditation or a free write around Michael, it was always there was always an issue with his father. And mm-hmm. I think he doesn't feel valued by his father. He has an older brother, and his older brother and his father were kind of thick as thieves. And Michael was much younger, and he often felt left out. And he felt as if his father didn't love him as much as his brother. And that came up every time I wrote about Michael. It was like that's who he kept telling me he was. And so that's certainly what motivates him early on. He feels responsible for his brother's arrest, and he wants to make it up to his father, and he wants his father to be proud of him. And it takes him a long time to realize that, and it comes through another father figure, an airman he's helping, that, the real value lies inside of himself.
Yeah.
But certainly I think 12-year-old boys especially want to be, they want their fathers to be proud of them.
Yeah, right.
They probably want that more than anything else in the world. I think even as they go on into an adulthood, I think boys and men still want that. So that was a big part of Michael's character.
And this was on a much smaller scale, but he had a friend who his family helped this friend out early in the book, and then that friend ended up working with sort of youths who were getting involved in the Nazi movement. And yeah. I thought that was interesting too, because I can't remember the name of the friend. Is it Pierre?
Pierre,
Pierre is trying to impress these other boys and really sort of makes the wrong choice. And even against Michael, whose family has helped Pierre. And again, that same theme of trying to impress others, making choices based on what you think other people will think of you. I thought that was a nice sort of subplot of that same theme, the whole story around Pierre.
Oh, thank you. I think also that Pierre's choice, early choice to get involved with this Nazi youth movement, was a lot of it was driven by fear.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, yes, to impress, I think partly to impress his father, who decides that the Nazis really aren't so bad. If we just go along, we won't get into trouble. Let's do that.
That's right, yeah.
He wants to impress his father, but also these other boys who seem to him to be strong and courageous, and they get all this special treatment because they're part of this Nazi youth movement. So,
right.
There was quite a bit of that.
Yeah, and I was—I won't give too much away here. I don't want to give away your plot, but I was pleased when Pierre actually sort of redeemed himself a tiny bit at one point in the book. So.
I think it's interesting that the longer the resistance went on, the less the average French person was willing to support or even ignore the Nazis. More and more and more and more people joined the resistance as the war went on, because the Nazis treated people really badly. And actually, had they gone into France and treated the people well, and the outcome might have been much different. But because the Nazis treated people so badly, more and more of the French people, and that must be true in other of the other occupied countries as well. The longer the war went on, the greater the resistance grew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about conflict in fiction, and this is historical fiction, mm-hmm. but still, the idea of conflict. There's conflict within Michael's circle of friends, and then later there's very important conflict in the character of Jerry, who's a sort of ungrateful English aviator. Again, someone Michael has helped, who then is not necessarily so helpful to Michael. If you could talk a little bit about the value of conflict in a plot.
Well, I think that there needs to be conflict in every single scene, and I try and think about in each scene, because that's what keeps us reading. If a character wants something and gets it, then there's not a lot of reason to keep reading if everything's all hunky-dory. So I think with each scene, I think about what my character wants and what's in his way, and I try to think about that for all of the characters in a scene. So it might be something simple, like your character wants milk for his coffee and somebody else has the milk container and won't let it go. But, I think that's a bad example, but I think with each scene, there has to be some level of conflict, whether it's internal, whether you want to do something and you're too afraid to do it, or whether it's external, you want something and somebody's stopping you from having it. So there are big and little conflicts, I think, throughout all of the best works of fiction.
Right, yeah. And I think it's really important as a writer to keep those in mind, to keep in mind in this particular scene, you know, what's going to keep the reader reading.
Right. And, I think Michael is battling a number of things. He's battling the Nazis. He's battling his own fear. He's battling his shame about his brother's arrest. So he's battling things all along, his hunger, his cold, all of those things. So his life is a constant battle.
Yeah, yeah. Just to talk a little bit longer about Jerry, the aviator. Can you talk a little bit about developing what I would call a sort of unsavory character?
Well, when I was doing my my research for this book, I discovered quite a few of the French people who helped the aviators didn't like all of them, and it was shocking to me because these people were risking their lives to help these Americans and these Englishmen, but not all of them were grateful, and not all of them acted acted very well. Some of them complained about the food or the lodging. These people had almost they needed ration tickets for everything. They were all starving, and they shared what little they had with these aviators, and some of them were not very grateful. And they complained about having to hide, and they complained about having to be inside, and they were in a hurry to go, and they didn't want to wait, and all of those things. So I was surprised by that, because I would think, gee, they would just be so grateful. They would do everything they were told and go on their way. I think perhaps in their defense that a lot of these men perhaps didn't know just how much was at risk, how much these people were putting at risk to help them, because men would be shot on the spot if they were caught helping an aviator, and women and children were sent to concentration camps. So it was really dangerous work that they did, and the men were not always grateful. And that's really sort of how Jerry was born. I wanted to show that, and I also wanted to keep the tension high in that latter part of the book. And part of a way to do that was to have one of the airmen who was not very grateful, who was perhaps too frightened to always do the right thing, and more than once tried to figuratively throw Michael under the bus.
Yeah, right.
So that's really how he came to be.
Okay. I was reading the acknowledgments at the end of the book, and I found it really funny that you actually named the English aviators after your writing group friends' husbands' names. Is that true?
It is true. I was on a writing retreat
that.
In the mountains with a writing group that meets every summer, and I was, just getting to the part where I needed to start naming these aviators, and I just, threw out to the room, "Do you guys mind if I use your husband's names?" And they all said no. And as I continued writing, of course, one of the husband's names. He turned out to be a real jerk. And so I wrote to my friends as I was finishing the novel, and I said, I just wanted to give you this opportunity. I still have your husband's names in here, but if you're uncomfortable, I will take them out. And one woman did not want her husband to be the jerk. And so I was going to change all of their names. And then my other friend volunteered. She said, "Oh, Jerry doesn't mind being a jerk. He can do that." So that's how the jerk got his name.
That was very funny.
But most of the aviators are my friend's husband's names.
Okay, great. I don't want to talk specifically about how the book ends, but I do want to talk a little bit about endings. I think most books that are written for children have endings that are very defined and everything's tied up neatly. And I loved that this book makes the ending more about the larger story of the resistance and the children who helped with the resistance, and not necessarily so much about Michael. I mean, we learn some about what happens to Michael, but we don't learn every single thing about what happens to Michael's family. And I loved that. And I'm wondering how your readers react to that.
I've been told that the ending of the novel is heartbreaking. But no one has said, "Why did you end it that way?" But I want, kids have asked me what happens to him later. But having, spent a year with Michael and writing his story, when I came to the end, I don't think I could have ended it any other way, and mm-hmm. I don't think he as a character would have let me. I think that's just the way the book has to end, and yeah. the war isn't over. So of course there are still things up in the air.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Stu asked me, you know, what happened to him, where did he go, and I've made up a story for them. But yeah, I don't think the book could have ended any other way, and I think the book ends on a hopeful note. I don't think you can write a kid's book and end without some kind of hope.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't think it was a heartbreaking ending. I thought it was a great ending personally, and I also thought that it was a great way to introduce young readers to the idea that that you know life goes on, and that every book is not an escape from reality that ties up all the neat bows, you know.
Yeah, I do. Some of my readers have said they wished it could have ended differently, but they sort of get that Michael wouldn't have done any other thing in that mm-hmm. instance. That's okay. Exactly what he would have done. So,
now beyond the ending, after you finish the book, you offer mm-hmm. Some historical notes and some information about historical figures. And one of the notes was about an actual young person named Jacques Luceron. Is that his name? I don't speak French, so I can't say it. But he was a teen who helped in the resistance, and he was blind. And I thought that was really amazing. I wondered how much you were able to learn about his story.
Well, he wrote a memoir, so I was able to read that. It's out of print now, it's out of print, but it is still available in some libraries. And so I was able to read his memoir, and he started a resistance ring very early on. He did different things. He didn't help the airmen the way Michael does, but he did different things. And he was one of those children who said to his parents, I'm going to be working with the resistance, and I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing, but this is what, you know, I am going to be in the resistance. And he was 17. He was older than Michael. Mm-hmm. And they, I guess, knew that they couldn't argue with him or question him about it. And so he kept this going throughout the war. And the interesting thing was that he felt like he could, because he couldn't see, he felt like he could judge people's characters based on their voices. And he never made a mistake. He never trusted somebody who should not have been trusted.
That's
but he
really
recruited friends and other people and kept his resistance going throughout the war. And it's funny, I found out about his memoir quite by accident, but there was Ethan Hawke, the actor, did a piece in Oprah magazine about books that were important to him, and this was one of them. And I know that movie rights have been sold to his book, and I guess there's been an attempt to make a movie based on his memoir, but I don't think it's gone anywhere yet. But somebody does own the movie rights, so maybe we'll hear more about him soon.
And when you read that book, had you already started writing this book, or were you in the early stages of your research?
No, I was actually quite far along. I think I had finished the first draft and was probably working on a revision. It's hard to remember now. But there were some little details in his memoir that struck me, and then added to my book. Like things like the day after the Germans arrived in France, the radio stations were filled with military music. And things like that. I mean, those were things I hadn't come across elsewhere. So little details like that, I think that can make day-to-day life seem more real.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about you as a reader as well. You mentioned early on that you were a voracious reader as a young person, and I'm sure you probably still are. So what are some of your favorite books, either for adults or for young readers?
Well, let's see. When I was growing up, I read the Little House books, and the Borrower series was a favorite of mine. I loved Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys and all of those mystery series. So I read a lot of those kinds of series when I was growing up. And then, I think was introduced to classics in school and things like that. Now, I honestly mostly read kids' books.
Mm-hmm.
But I read... Long after I finished Michael, I discovered there's a novel for adults about these same rescue rings, these same underground railroads, called The Girl in the Blue Beret by Avianne Mason. And that's told from the point of view of a pilot who goes back to France 40 years later to meet with the people who rescued him. So that was something I read recently and liked a lot. I just read a book called Rock in the River about the Black Panther movement in the 1960s. It's also a novel for children by Keklen Magoon that was wonderful. For teenagers, one of my favorite authors is Sarah Dessen. And for middle grade readers, I love, you know, the people like Jerry Spinelli and Andrew Clements and Dan Gutman. I guess I like boy books because they all write a lot of boy books.
Right, yeah. What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on a ghostwriting project, so I can't talk too much about that. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking about what my next historical novel should be. I don't have another Boys of Wartime book under contract, so I can actually do something totally different, and I just don't know what that will be yet. I've always loved books set in New York City, and the Lower East Side Tenement Museum here in New York City has always been a really interesting place to me, and Ellis Island. So I was thinking I might do a book set in, you know, pre-Depression era New York about an immigrant, but I don't really know. I'm sort of just playing with ideas right now. I'm mm-hmm. also writing a book for American Girl. I write for their Interstar University series, and those books do have my name on them. And I'm writing a book called Science Star for that series. Okay. So,
okay. Now, Michael at the Invasion of France is published by Dial. Is Dial doing all the Boys of Wartime books so far?
Yes. Well, Dial is a division of Penguin, and actually the first two books in the Boys of Wartime series, Daniel at the Siege of Boston and Will at the Battle of Gettysburg, were published by the Dutton division of the Penguin Young Readers Group. But they made some changes, so now the hardcovers are published by Dial, and all of the paperbacks will be published by Puffin. Okay. But it's all part of Penguin Young Readers Group.
We talked a little bit before about how some of the characters were named after the husbands of writing friends. I'm wondering, at this point in time, do you get feedback from people before you submit your work, or are you mostly, was that just a conference, did you say, or do you have a regular writing group?
I have two actual regular writing groups. I have one here in New York, and we meet weekly, and we read usually a chapter or two to each other every week and get feedback. And I find that feedback very valuable, and they... when one of us finishes a novel, we do sit down and read the whole thing and devote a meeting to that. And I also have this summer writing group. We met at a children's writers conference in North Carolina, I think about 10 or 11 years ago now. And we, the next summer, decided to do our own writing retreat. And when we started, we did a lot of critiquing of each other's work and giving each other feedback. And now we mostly just get together and write. But they are certainly available to call on to read and give advice, as I am for them. So that's been a really valuable thing in my life as well. So I love being in both of those groups.
How large is each of those groups? How many people?
The group that gets together in the summer, there's 8 of us in total, and usually 5 or 6 people are able to join in any given summer, able to show up for the retreat. My writing group in New York... it's usually at 4 or 5 people. We just lost 2 people who left New York, so we're looking for new published members here in New York. But so 4 or 5, I think, is ideal.
And are they all children's writers, or are they all different?
We're all children's writers. I think it's hard to critique adult writing when your head is in the children's writing world mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. It does help to be writing for the same age group.
Yeah. Yeah, although I wonder now, if it were nonfiction versus fiction, would that be hard, or is it really just about the audience that you're working toward?
I think it's more about the audience. I write quite a bit of nonfiction. I had a book come out in December called I Grew Up to Be President, which is sort of a short encyclopedia with brief biographies of all of the presidents. And one of the other members of our group also writes nonfiction. So we do address both fiction and nonfiction in the group.
Okay. What advice do you have for writers who are attempting to begin writing for young adults or writing for children?
Well, I think the most important thing is to read a lot of books for children and for young adults. There's one writer, Linda Sue Park, who has won a Newbery Award, who says you should read 1,000 books before you begin writing.
Mm.
I'm not sure that you have to go quite that far, but there are far too many people who say they want to write a book for children, but in fact haven't read one since they were a child themselves, or only read to, you know, to their own children. And I think, you know, you just have to really know what's out there and what's being published and what the parameters are in terms of length and vocabulary and all of those things. I think you have to be really familiar with the literature before you start. And then the other thing I think is to just get to know your own voice. I mean, for me, it was probably spending 6 months or a year writing every morning without having a specific target in mind, just to write every day. And that's how I found my voice as a children's writer. So I think if you're just getting started, don't put too much pressure on yourself to produce something, to produce a novel or a picture book or a short story, but simply to just write until you get to know your voice and start to learn about where your interests are and, you know, what kind of characters you like to create and what kind of stories come to you.
So mm-hmm.
I think just when you're starting to read a lot and to write a lot without that pressure of having to produce something is important.
Now, that's really interesting. So when you spent that time writing before you started on a specific project, were you journaling or were you writing what might have turned into plot lines, or what kind of work was that?
It was a little of both.
Okay.
It was a little of both. I would get an idea and I would work on it for a few days. I wrote a couple of nonfiction essays. I worked on an adult novel idea for a while. I started a short story. But I didn't really get going. I wasn't really excited and engaged. It felt like a chore almost, like it was something I had to be doing. And I started to believe, gee, maybe I'm not a writer at all. But I didn't start to get really engaged and passionate about it until I came up with this idea for a children's novel. And then I had to sort of go back and start reading contemporary stuff, because I was like a lot of people who say they want to write for children. I hadn't read a children's book in a long time. So, again, I just did a lot of reading before I tried to turn my idea into a story.
And it sounds like it came as a surprise to you that you were going to be a children's writer.
It did. Which was a big surprise to me.
That must have been kind of a relief, though, if you were in a phase of questioning the project in the first place. It must have been almost a relief to say, oh, well, maybe I'm this kind of writer, and then you can kind of start over with a new attitude. Does that?
Yeah. It was a big relief, because I started to think that after 20 years of thinking I wanted to be a writer one day, I started to think that I wasn't really one. It was just a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I landed on that idea and got really excited and passionate about it and then discovered this whole world of children's literature that I loved, it was a huge relief, and I was just delighted.
So how long was it from the moment that you started writing, you know, getting up early in the mornings when you still had a full-time job, to the moment that your first book came out?
Probably 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
I was shopping, and I became, and the first things I had published were freelance assignments. I was shopping around my first novel when I got an offer to write a freelance novel that I thought was going to turn into a whole series. And I was very excited about it and decided to leave my job to take on this new freelance gig. And unfortunately, it fell apart after one book, and that book was never published. But that led to my career as a freelance writer, because suddenly I was out there in the world with no job and just one or two credits to my name. And so I really used those to get assignments.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like a kind of hard way to start.
It was a little scary in the beginning, but The publishing world was contracting then, as it seems always to be, and people were getting laid off, and there weren't a lot of jobs. But I knew there were writing jobs out there if I just kept at it. So it was something I had prepared for a long time.
Okay.
I had been saving my money to leave my day job for a long time before I actually did it, and so I didn't have to quite go into panic mode, because I knew I would be okay for, you know, good 6 to 9 months. So.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, that's great.
So that helped. Yeah. So I would tell that to anyone who's getting ready to leave their day job. Make sure you have money in the bank, because you might need it.
Yeah.
I know I did.
Right. Even a contract isn't necessarily something to rely on.
That's true. I did get paid for that first book, but of course all the other books under option were never going to be. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Lori, I very much enjoyed speaking with you today and reading Michael at the Invasion of France, 1943, and that's published by Dial. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you. It was really delightful.
So that, again, was a conversation with Lori Kalkovin. I hope you enjoyed that. You can read more about her work at her website, www.lorikalkovin.com. She says you do need the www in this case. Her name is spelled LauriKalkovin. Lori will be teaching her workshop on character meditations, which she calls Inner Lives, Acting Techniques That Dig Deep Into Character, at a conference that's coming up the weekend of April 20th. It's the New England SCBWI Conference in Springfield, Mass. It's going to take place Friday, April 20th through Sunday the 22nd. Her workshop is on the 20th, and you can read more about that and other workshops at which she participates on her website. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Lori Kalkovin, who likes working on character meditations in preparation for writing. So that's your prompt for the week. Meditate on your character. Begin with a simple breathing meditation for 5 or 10 minutes to relax. And then picture your character walking toward you. And as you imagine your character getting close enough to actually sit on your shoulder, ask yourself a question about your character. Lori keeps a collection of index cards on her desk with prepared prompts for asking herself questions about the characters. She says the element of surprise keeps the meditation spontaneous, and so she shuffles her index cards and keeps them face down on her desk until she needs one, and then she turns one over, not letting herself see what it says before it's time. One example of what might be written on the card: your character is holding something in his hand. What is it? That's how she came to include a newspaper for Michael and Jacques to use in their covert activities in France. Here are a few more suggestions to put on your index cards. What is your character wearing? How does your character walk? Does he have any particular expression on his face? Why? What might he be reacting to? Who is she going to meet? And what will be the first thing she says to that person? Now make up some of your own prompts, put them on index cards, shuffle your deck, and try meditation on your character. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you are a Facebook user, please like us. It's called Write the Book Radio Show. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And as always, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then also remember that this station, The Radiator, is here thanks to community support and involvement. The Radiator is completely volunteer-run. It is a nonprofit. Everybody who does anything here does it out of love for the station and the community, and love of radio, love of music, love of books, whatever. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. So this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, in Burlington, Vermont.